Fanning, weekends on 2FM.
Now, last week it was announced that a consortium led by Saudi Arabia's Public Investment Fund had purchased Newcastle United from Chief Executive of Frasers Group, Mike Ashley. Now, while some Newcastle fans have been rejoicing at the prospects of silverware and bringing elite footballers to the underperforming club, most other football fans are concerned over the involvement of Saudi Arabia because of the country's record on human rights. And I can tell you now, it's not good. Amnesty International have even requested a meeting with the Premier League chief executive about the takeover. So why has this particular deal caused such controversy? What other sales have stirred the pot in the past? And what's the future for club football? Well, chief football writer at The Independent in the UK, Miguel Delaney, is here with us now. So Miguel, thanks for coming back to the programme. First of all, can you give us a bit of background on the actual takeover itself, the takeover of Newcastle United from Mike Ashley?
Well, it's 18 months in the waiting, for one thing, which is, I suppose, caused significant build-up in some of the reaction, both from the celebrations on the Newcastle side and the criticisms on the other side. But also, of course, it's part of a much wider spectrum. And I think many people would rightly say it's a new low for football. I mean, Saudi Arabia, or through their public investment fund, which is the sovereign state fund, who now own 80% of Newcastle, the goal of this ownership is a sports washing project, just as Abu Dhabi have done with Manchester City before and Qatar have done with Paris Saint-Germain. They are basically looking to use the immense social cachet of a football club as a form of reputation laundering to further investment opportunities or revenue opportunities, as everyone says, once the oil runs out. And one of the phrases people use is revenue diversification for the future. But yeah, that's what it's ultimately about. It is a form of, as any human rights expert would say, a form of reputation laundering and using the immense power of a football club to do that. Now, as you know, as I've alluded to there, there is a spectrum to this. Manchester City happened in 2008, Qatar and France in 2011. And there are all sorts of questions about many other owners in the Premier League, from venture capitalists to then you can even go to kind of the franchise model that's being used in Germany with Leipzig by Red Bull. But I suppose why this feels such a specific low is because there's been such a long build-up. At this point, there's absolutely no reason why the Premier League can't have some sort of regulations or rules in place where they say a state or a state fund can't own a football club. I mean, you would think that should be, at the very least, a basic requirement. Because what is a football club ultimately about? A football club is about playing the sport as representation of their local community. That's it. And anything that goes against that aim or those objectives or that core principle should really be scrutinized and almost prohibited from working in the sport. But that hasn't been the case. And there's been a lot of commentary on this, but it doesn't just reflect kind of football's own embrace of hyper-capitalism and a lack of regulation and a lack of appreciation for what our social institutions. That's that. I mean, as so many articles said in the meantime since, it reflects almost the economic culture of Britain now.
Okay, well then, this one in particular, why am I thinking that this one, it might be to the point of the straw that breaks the camel's back or something, or a step too far? I mean, we're talking here about an autocratic ruler of a murderous state, and there are legally binding assurances that Saudi will not control the club, but that is complete and utter nonsense. Saudi Arabia is in full control of the club. So with all of that, and it's all about the reputational rehabilitation of Mohammed bin Salman, etc., all of these things, this one here, is that because... Is this why this one is bigger than Manchester City and this one is bigger than PSG? Because you can point to it and say, for crying out loud, lads, step too far.
Yeah, it also feels that bit more transparent and that bit more... Yeah. Even the fact it's a sovereign state fund, or sovereign wealth fund, buying the club. And of course, I mean, as a lot of people have pointed out, it's very conspicuous. This has been confirmed or completed on the three-year anniversary of the death of the journalist Jamal Khashoggi. As so many human rights experts would say, they see it as a specific attempt to almost push back against the immense criticism this Saudi Arabian regime received for that, of course, to go with all manner of other human rights questions. But there is a difference. I mean, when Abu Dhabi bought Manchester City in 2008, first of all, it was done through what was a private fund. Now, the reality is the same as Newcastle. Ultimately, Abu Dhabi owned Manchester City in the same way Saudi Arabia owned Newcastle. But from a legal perspective, there was a little bit of a difference. Also, at that point, it was a much more naive football world.
Yeah.
The concept of sports washing didn't exist. Even if you want to get into kind of the criticisms of these states, there hadn't been a war in Yemen yet. And really, it's only in the last 3 or 4 years, and it's through the work of human rights activists like Nicholas McGeehan, who works for Fair Square now, previously worked for Human Rights Watch, who have really brought exposure to this and what these states are doing. So the football world is a whole lot less naive than it was in 2008. And we've had so much forewarning on this. And now we get to this situation where sports washing has been a topic for at least the last 3 years, where we're all so much more aware of states trying to do this. And also in this specific case where it's so direct, where it's, I mean, it's literally called the Public Investment Fund. It's literally described as the sovereign wealth fund. This is the state. And for the Premier League to be indulging in this absolute fantasy that there's a, you know, I so many journalists got the same briefings last week. And, you know, the phrase that kept being repeated, as you said there, legally binding assurances. Anyone that's an expert in Saudi Arabia will tell you that is complete nonsense. I mean, you don't even have to be an expert. This is a sovereign wealth fund with Mohammed bin Salman, who is the de facto ruler of the state.
And one of the people involved in Newcastle Football Club has actually said, yeah, this is a great deal because the private investment fund is separate from the Saudi state. No, it isn't. I mean, stop. Like, so just take me to PSG and to Manchester City, which is 11 years ago or 10 years ago and 13 years ago. One of the things about both of those, would any footballer, I mean, look at the forward line of PSG. It's the, you know, the biggest thing in the world. Would any footballer ever say, who's absolutely brilliant and worth loads of money, oh, I'm not going to that club? Have you ever heard of that?
No, I haven't. But that is, the wonder is whether that question will start to arise now. The prevailing view in football for so long has basically been, it's not the player's fault. They have to earn a living. They want to compete for the top trophies. And this is the reality of the game. But in a word, what's really interesting about this, because this is a new world of sportsman activism, even half a decade ago, less than that, actually, the approach among the vast majority of footballers was to leave politics to one side. I mean, it was basically the Michael Jordan attitude, you know, Republicans wear sneakers too. Mm-hmm. Which is why they'd never express a political sentiment. But Marcus Rashford has been among a few players that have changed that. Then, of course, we've seen in the last year the whole movement from the killing of George Floyd, which led to taking the knee. So it's a new world of football activism. And I think that's a very good thing. But the next question isn't to accuse players of hypocrisy, because I think that would be unhelpful.
Right.
But it's to ask the next step. So, for example, we say with taking the knee, the players are obviously making a very admirable stand against racial inequality and in many of their specific cases pointing to racism they've suffered. Yet so far, the vast majority, bar a few cases like Norway, like the Netherlands, like the Germany.
Yeah.
So there's been very little criticism, say, of the World Cup in Qatar next year from players. And that criticized for what are essentially racial discrimination in terms of how migrant workers are treated. So you couldn't have a clearer case of what they're talking about. But the World Cup is one thing, of course. The other side of that is, the deeper element of the Qatari sports washing project isn't the World Cup. Much more successful for them has actually been the takeover of Paris Saint-Germain.
Yeah.
But despite players on one hand talking about taking action against racism, they're also ultimately willing to play for Paris Saint-Germain, who were ultimately owned by Qatar. And while I think players and managers and any other football staff have generally been given a pass so far, because like everyone, there's a certain amount of hypocrisy basically to live in the world.
Yeah.
But and an element of realpolitik and all the rest of it. But these questions will start to arise.
Yeah, I'd say in 2022 it's going to get bigger and bigger, mainly because of Qatar and the fact that in November, December of next year the World Cup takes place. But it's funny, like, did Russia dodge a bullet 4 or 5 years ago? Because as you say, this sports washing thing is really like out in the open in the last 3 or 4 years. And it was just beforehand that they had their Olympics.
Yeah.
It's just beforehand that they had their World Cup, all that.
In fact, I was even looking back at my own coverage of the Russian World Cup, and I did write a bit about the political side of it, but probably not as strong as I'd go now.
Yeah.
Because we're all so much more aware of it. Now, I suppose Russia was a bit more of a complicated situation because there is a long established football culture there. And then when it came to it, there was all sorts of talk that Putin didn't actually want the World Cup at all. He saw it as an inconvenience. So there was a few more maybe grey areas to it than what we're seeing with Qatar and what the next one. Sure, like one of the big plans is for Saudi Arabia to eventually get the World Cup as well. And of course, the president of FIFA, Gianni Infantino, his latest is now a World Cup in Israel, because Israel and Palestine and across the Middle East, because he sees that he basically wants a Nobel Peace Prize.
So bringing it back to here, what do you call it? Abramovich for Chelsea. People didn't seem to worry too much when you'd see the camera would catch him hiding behind the sort of stanchion up at the very back of the stand. Sure, why not? He owns Chelsea. It's great. He put money in.
But I think that's one of the problems football has got itself into, where ultimately it's realised what's happened far too late.
Yeah.
And like the Abramovich takeover, that really moved the dial on football club ownership. Now, because he's a private billionaire, like from talking to people in the area, I think they would they put it in a different sphere. But it still it changed the nature of club ownership, and suddenly, before football realised what was actually happening, and specifically English football, we're now in a situation where it's basically completely unregulated. And I mean, and this proves it.
What about the like of, for instance, Spurs, which is a good example, I would imagine, saying, listen, we played fair and we're up against all of this now for PSG, if we want to be in Europe, or even for the top six in the Premiership, etc., like for Manchester City. It is like, you know, Spurs are playing by the rules, aren't they? And others aren't, or they could say that.
Well, I mean, these are the sort of interesting questions we get into, I suppose, because or the thorny questions as well, because Spurs supporters would regularly criticise their owner, Joe Louis, who's a billionaire, for not investing that much, for basically running the club as kind of on not fulfilling their potential. But of course, all those questions just pale next to what is actually going to happen with the Newcastle ownership. Yeah. They belong in a completely different sphere. One is kind of the sporting running of a club. The other is the use of football clubs for other purposes. And I think it's the latter that is so problematic in all this. It's basically, because again, to return to what I said at the start, football clubs should purely be about playing football for representation of community. As soon as you have ulterior motives to that, that's when there should be regulation. That's what happens in Germany. And there's such a contrast between the English context and the German context, where in Germany, they have the rule, which Red Bull have actually managed to circumvent with Leipzig. But in every other case, the fans own, it's the 50 plus one ownership model, where a majority of the club will always be in the hands of the fans. And I mean, that's what a club should be about. And it's why you'll never get a situation in Germany where a Saudi Arabia, or where there can be a state washing project.
But let's bring it back down to the fans. And, like, you know, where does it get very awkward for somebody like Alan Shearer, who suddenly now is expected to speak, because he's Mr. Newcastle, isn't he?
Yeah, and fans are in an invidious position there. I mean, as has been frequently said by Newcastle fans, they can't control who owns the club. And I completely get that. And I must say, there has been a debate over whether Newcastle fans or any fans of any such clubs who have problematic owners should walk away for moral reasons. I would actually disagree with that, because I think with modern football now, so much is up for sale and so much can be appropriated just through sheer force of money, that football fans should actually try and keep the identity of their club. And that means going. But there's a difference between not being able to control who owns your club and how you act in response to that. So I think conflicted fans going to the game and keeping an element of the club is theirs. For me, that would be completely fine. But I think there's very fair questions to be asked of some of the scenes in Newcastle last Thursday, where, okay, they would say they were celebrating the end of Mike Ashley's time, but ultimately that is inseparable from what this is. And because the other side of it is basically a regime as problematic as this coming in. And I have to say, it felt almost dystopian for, a state with this sort of record to be welcomed or praised in any way. I mean, it's absolutely remarkable when you think about it.
Also, it rolls out to the whole city and it diminishes the democratic institutions of it. And like some of the stuff that's happened in Manchester has not necessarily been great. Luxury apartments all over the place with this money, and the homelessness crisis is getting actually worse. So what will Newcastle look like as a football club if this takeover is not rolled back on?
Well, I think that's a very interesting question, because I'm writing a piece as we speak, or a research piece, on what next for the club.
Yeah.
And I don't think it'll be as easy for them to quickly rise to the very top of English and European football in the way Manchester City and Chelsea did. That's because there are more clubs like that now. And also because there are more, at least some spending caps in terms of kind of the relative effect of financial fair play. There are also questions about how much the Saudis themselves are going to invest. From speaking to people in the area as well, Abu Dhabi, who own Manchester City, are seen as basically much slicker in how they operate in these things than the Saudis are in similar operations. So, I mean, what they did with Manchester City was basically they realized we have to get the best in class here. We have to appoint, they looked around football and looked at who would be considered the Facebook or the Apple of football, those that are ahead of their field. So what do? They went to Barcelona of 2011 and basically appropriated their brains trust. So you have Cheeky Beguristain, Ferran Soriano, and of course, ultimately Pep Guardiola, who had all been at Barcelona for that real glory, or which many would say was the peak of football, if you like. From what we've heard of Newcastle so far, there's nothing close to that level of expertise. They've got Amanda Staveley, who has been the public face of this bid. And I suppose she's ultimately done well to pull it off in purely terms of this ownership being completed. But already I'm hearing about how, so Steve Bruce, the former Manchester United captain, who is from Newcastle, but he's the deeply unpopular manager of the club because he's associated with the Mike Ashley regime. And from what everything I've heard this week, they want to replace him, but apparently that process has already been haphazard. The people in the football aren't that impressed. And it's going to be interesting to see what sort of decisions they take and how sophisticated it actually is. I mean, in football, there is there's a fairly clear correlation between your wage bill and your league position. It generally correlates 90% of the time, or around those figures. But of course, there is a certain allowance for error, and that's kind of the thing with Newcastle. I suppose they will probably throw enough money to rise up the table, but whether they can be as dominant as
Well, I think that's the first point, though, is just to rise up the table, because otherwise it's relegation. They're second last, as we speak. I mean, Gary Neville has famously been calling for an independent regulator over the past few years, which would ensure that clubs can't go rogue. So basically, I suppose, watch this space, see what happens. Chief football writer at The Independent in the UK, Miguel Delaney. Miguel, thanks a million for joining us on the programme today.
Dave Fanning, weekends on 2FM.